This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents The Triumph of Christianity: How a Forbidden Religion Swept the World by Bart D. Ehrman. Read by George Newbern. With an introduction read by the author.
Introduction. In my junior year of college, I took a course in English literature that made me understand for the first time how painful it can be to question your faith. The course introduced me to poets of the 19th century who were struggling with religion. Even though I was a deeply committed Christian at the time, I became obsessed with the work of the great Victorian poet of doubt, Matthew Arnold. Nowhere is Arnold's struggle expressed more succinctly and movingly than in that most famous of 19th century poems, Dover Beach. The poem recalls a brief moment from Arnold's honeymoon in 1851. While standing by an open window overlooking the cliffs of Dover, Arnold takes in the shoreline below, mesmerized by the sights and sounds of the sea as the tide goes out. The sea is calm tonight, the tide is full, the moon lies fair upon the straits. On the French coast, the light gleams and is gone. The cliffs of England stand, glimmering and vast, out in the tranquil bay. He asks his bride to join him at the window to enjoy the sweet night air and to look down where the waves break upon the beach. Listen, you hear the grating roar of pebbles which the waves draw back and fling at the return up the high strand. Begin and cease, and then again begin, with tremulous cadence slow, and bring the eternal note of sadness in. This is the sound, he notes, that Sophocles described many centuries before in his play Antigone, a sound that made the Greek dramatist think of the turbid ebb and flow of human misery. The sound gives Arnold a thought as well, but one quite different and particularly attuned to his age. For Arnold, the retreating sea is a sad metaphor for the Christian faith, ebbing from his world and leaving a naked shoreline in its wake. There was a time, he wistfully recalls, when the world was comfortably filled to the full with faith. The sea of faith was once, too, at the full, and round earth's shore lay like the folds of a bright girdle furled. But that sea, too, is now retreating, and one can hear the sucking sound as it pulls back from the shore. But now I only hear its melancholy, long withdrawing roar, retreating to the breath of the night wind, down the vast edges drear and naked shingles of the world. For Arnold, the modern educated person no longer has the comforts of religion, the presence of an all-powerful and loving divinity, or the redemption provided by a Son of God who has come into the world to save those who are lost. In the void left by the withdrawal of the Christian faith, all that remains is a confusing and chaotic emptiness, filled only in part by the presence of others, the people we love and cherish who can join us through the uncertainties, pains, and anxieties of life. And so he concludes his poem. Ah, love, let us be true to one another. For the world which seems to lie before us like a land of dreams, so various, so beautiful, so new, hath really neither joy, nor love, nor light, nor certitude, nor peace, nor help for pain. And we are here as on a darkling plain, swept with confused alarms of struggle and flight, where ignorant armies clash by night. Here is a world of profound and disastrous mayhem and confusion, a struggle of armies fighting to the death, in the dark, with no joy, peace, or certainty. In this void we have only our friends, companions, and loves. Ah, love, let us be true to one another. Dover Beach and other poems of its era resonated with me as a young college student because I was beginning to move through my own 19th century. In my liberal arts education, I had begun learning about the geological and biological sciences, philosophy, critical thinking, and intellectual history, all of which posed problems for my faith, much as they had for the intellectuals of Arnold's era. And I too found my emerging doubts deeply disturbing. Now, 40 years later, I have a different perspective on these 19th-century struggles. Rather than experiencing them personally as a Christian, I look on them as a historian specializing in the study of religion. Even though I myself am no longer at sea, I can empathize with those who have been racked with doubt and uncertainty, forced to reconsider and even abandon their faith, not simply since the rise of modernity, but throughout history. The Christian Revolution. In the first four Christian centuries, the religions of the Roman Empire came under assault by those proposing a new faith, declaring that only the worship of the God of Jesus could be considered true religion. As Christianity spread, it destroyed the other religions in its wake, religions that had been practiced for millennia and that were simply assumed everywhere and by everyone to be good and true. But Christians insisted they were evil and false. For those reluctant to accept these claims, or even those unsure of what to believe, this transition was no less agonizing than that of Victorians living centuries later. The Christian Revolution proved far more massive and its triumph far more enduring than the skepticism that emerged as a counterforce in the 19th century. Even though many Victorians experienced radical doubt or left the faith altogether, the Christian tradition did not disappear. There are still 2 billion Christians in the world. By way of contrast, in antiquity, when Christianity succeeded in taking over the Roman Empire, any pagan religions left in its wake were merely isolated and scattered vestiges of ancient superstition. The ancient triumph of Christianity proved to be the single greatest cultural transformation our world has ever seen. Without it, the entire history of late antiquity would not have happened as it did. We would never have had the Middle Ages, the Reformation, the Renaissance, or modernity as we know it. There could never have been a Matthew Arnold, or any of the Victorian poets, or any of the other authors of our canon, no Milton, no Shakespeare, no Chaucer. We would have had none of our revered artists, Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci, or Rembrandt, and none of our brilliant composers, Mozart, Handel, or Bach. To be sure, we would have had other Miltons, Michelangelos, and Mozarts in their places, and it's impossible to know whether these would have been better or worse, but they would have been incalculably different. By conquering the Roman world and then the entire West, Christianity not only gave rise to a vast and awe-inspiring set of cultural artifacts, it also changed the way people looked at the world and chose to live in it. Modern sensitivities, values, and ethics have all been radically affected by the Christian tradition. This is true for almost all who live in the West, whether they claim allegiance to Christianity, to some other religious tradition, or to none at all. Before the triumph of Christianity, the Roman Empire was phenomenally diverse, but its inhabitants shared a number of cultural and ethical assumptions. If one word could encapsulate the common social, political, and personal ethic of the time, it would be dominance. In a culture of dominance, those with power are expected to assert their will over those who are weaker. Rulers are to dominate their subjects, patrons their clients, masters their slaves, men their women. This ideology was not merely a cynical grab for power or a conscious mode of oppression. It was the common sense, millennia-old view that virtually everyone accepted and shared, including the weak and marginalized. This ideology affected both social relations and governmental policy. It made slavery a virtually unquestioned institution promoting the good of society. It made the male head of a household a sovereign despot over all those who were under him. It made wars of conquest and the slaughter they entailed natural and sensible for the well-being of the valued part of the human race, that is, those invested with power. With such an ideology, one would not expect to find governmental welfare programs to assist weaker members of society, the poor, homeless, hungry, or oppressed. One would not expect to find hospitals to assist the sick, injured, or dying. One would not expect to find private institutions of charity designed to help those in need. The Roman world did not have such things. Christians, however, advocated a different ideology. Leaders of the Christian church preached and urged an ethic of love and service. One person was not more important than another. All were on the same footing before God. The master was no more significant than the slave, the patron than the client, the husband than the wife, the powerful than the weak, or the robust than the diseased. Whether those Christian ideals worked themselves out in practice is another question. Christians sometimes, indeed many times, spectacularly failed to match their pious sentiments with concrete actions, or, even more, acted in ways contrary to their stated ideals. But the ideals were nonetheless ensconced in their tradition, widely and publicly proclaimed by the leaders of the movement, in ways not extensively found elsewhere in Roman society. As Christians came to occupy positions of power, these ideals made their way into people's social lives, into private institutions meant to encapsulate them, and into governmental policy. The very idea that society should serve the poor, the sick, and the marginalized became a distinctively Christian concern. Without the conquest of Christianity, we may well never have had institutionalized welfare for the poor or organized health care for the sick. Billions of people may never have embraced the idea that society should serve the marginalized or be concerned with the well-being of the needy, values that most of us in the West have simply assumed are human values. This is not to say that Judaism, the religion from which Christianity emerged, was any less concerned with the obligations to love your neighbor as yourself and do unto others as you would have them do unto you. But neither Judaism nor, needless to say, any of the other great religions of the world took over the empire and became the dominant religion of the West. It was Christianity that became dominant, and once dominant, advocated an ideology not of dominance, but of love and service. This affected the history of the West in ways that simply cannot be calculated. Explaining the triumph of Christianity. But there was no reason this cultural shift had to happen, no historical necessity that Christianity would, in effect, destroy the pagan religions of the Roman Empire and establish itself as the supreme religion and ascendant political and cultural power of its world. That's why the question I address in this book is so important. Why did this new faith take over the Roman world, leading to the Christianization of the West? It's obviously not a matter of purely antiquarian interest, relevant only to academic historians. What question could be more important for anyone interested in history, culture, or society? To be more specific, how did a small handful of the followers of Jesus come to convert an unwilling empire? According to the New Testament, some days after Jesus' crucifixion, 11 of his male followers and several women came to believe he had been raised from the dead. Before 4 centuries had passed, these 20 or so lower-class, illiterate Jews from rural Galilee had become a church of some 30 million. How does a religion gain 30 million adherents in 300 years? As I give lectures around the country on a variety of topics related to early Christianity, this is the question I hear more than any other. The answers people suggest are wide-ranging. Many committed Christians appeal directly to divine providence. God did it. God guided history so the world would become Christian. I respect those who have this opinion, but I have one very big problem with it. If God wanted the world to become Christian, why hasn't the world become Christian? If God wanted the masses to convert, why are most of the masses still not converted? Moreover, just in historical terms, if God made the Roman Empire Christian, why did it take so long? And why was the job never completed? Why did non-Christian religions continue to exist at all? Why are they still in the majority today? By far the most common secular answer I hear is that the Roman Empire became Christian because the Roman Emperor Constantine converted to the faith. Constantine was the sole ruler of the empire in the first part of the 4th century. Early in his reign, he turned from traditional pagan religions to become a follower of Christ. After that, masses of people began to convert as Christianity went from being a persecuted minority to being the religion of most favored status, and eventually the religion of Rome. So it was all about Constantine, right? Until recently, that's what I myself thought. But I no longer think so. On the contrary, I think Christianity may well have succeeded even if Constantine had not converted. That will be one of the theses of this book. Still, it cannot be disputed that after Constantine's conversion, masses of people came to embrace the Christian faith. Not absolutely everyone, and not immediately after Constantine did so. Indeed, not even a century after Constantine's death. But eventually, Christianity became the religion of the multitudes, and the Roman pagan religions they had formerly practiced more or less disappeared, or, in a few instances, went underground. For those supporting the Christian cause, this has always been considered a real triumph. I will not, however, be writing this book in a triumphalist vein. That is to say, I will not be celebrating the rise and eventual domination of Christianity, claiming that it was inherently superior, or even necessarily a very good thing. On the other hand, I do not want to claim it was bad either. Ultimately good or ultimately bad, as a historian, I will remain neutral on these kinds of value judgments. In part, this is because the triumph of Christianity also entailed losses, especially for the devoted followers of other religious practices. Whenever one group wins a struggle, others lose. Those of us with historical interest need to consider both winners and losers. Winners and losers. And so, before detailing the remarkable events that led to the triumph of Christianity, I want to pause to reflect on loss. Nowhere in modern times have the losses occasioned by clashes of religions and cultures crystallized more dramatically than in the city of Palmyra, Syria, where, in 2015, representatives of ISIS captured the city, executed a number of its inhabitants, destroyed archaeological remains, and ravaged its antiquities, torturing and beheading their chief conservator. Nothing of equal savagery has ever affected the site. But this was not the first time Palmyra endured an assault by religious fanatics who found its sacred temples and the holy objects they contained objectionable. For that, we need to turn the clock back 1,700 years. The ancient city of Palmyra lay to the northeast of Damascus, almost exactly midway between the Mediterranean in the west and the Euphrates in the east. Originally a caravan oasis, it became a center of transport and commerce, an obvious stopping point at the crossroads between Rome and Persia. As it grew in size and economic importance, Palmyra attracted the attention of Mediterranean powers from the Greeks in the 4th century BCE to the Romans later on. Assaulted by Mark Antony in 41 BCE, it was eventually incorporated into the empire under Tiberius, emperor 14 to 37 CE. 2.5 centuries later, it established its independence as a breakaway state, ruled most famously by Queen Zenobia, until its reconquest by the Roman Emperor Aurelian in 272 CE. Taking Zenobia captive for his triumph back in Rome, Aurelian eventually ordered the city's destruction. Although partially rebuilt, it was never again to return to its former glory. Its magnificent private and public structures stood for centuries, isolated in the Syrian desert. The first recorded instance of specifically religious intolerance leading to the destruction of Palmyra's antiquities occurred at the end of the 4th century. The Roman imperial throne was occupied at the time by Theodosius I, ruled 379 to 95 CE, a passionately committed Christian determined to establish Christianity as the official religion of the empire. Theodosius was not the first Christian emperor. That, as I have indicated, was Constantine, ruled 306 to 37 CE. And Theodosius was not the first Christian emperor to order the destruction of pagan temples. That was Constantine's son, Constantius II, ruled 337 to 61. But Theodosius was the first to legislate Christianity as the one legitimate religion and to order a general cessation of pagan practices. The enforcement of Theodosius's policies was spotty at best, but it did affect Palmyra and at least one of its most glorious sacred shrines, the Temple of Allat, the Syrian pagan goddess. Allat was worshipped by nomads throughout the region and eventually came to be identified as the Greek goddess Athena. An archaeological team from Poland excavated the ruins of her temple in the spring seasons of 1975 and 1976. Inscriptions discovered at the site, along with coins, pottery, and a severely mutilated statue of the divinity, allowed these experts to write the history of the sanctuary. Built in the middle of the 2nd century CE, the sanctuary stood for over 200 years, until being destroyed sometime in the 380s. It did not perish from natural causes, such as an earthquake or storm. That much is clear from the remains of the cult statue, whose facial figures have been intentionally mutilated. As the archaeological report notes, this kind of mutilation suggests that it was done by a man of set purpose rather than by brute forces of nature. We know of numerous other statue mutilations around the empire from about the same time. They were not perpetrated by thoughtless, godless hordes, but by committed Christians with clear intentions. Statues of pagan deities often had their eyes, noses, ears, mouths, hands, and genitals removed. This was a religious statement. The gods of the pagans were nothing but stone or wood. They could not see, smell, hear, speak, or act. They were useless, lifeless, and dead. The Christians were out to prove it. The date established for the destruction of the Temple of Allat is particularly telling. It coincides with some of the most virulent anti-religious legislation the ancient world had ever seen. From 381 to 392 CE, Theodosius issued laws forbidding pagan sacrifice and ordering the closing of pagan temples. This legislation, like most legislation throughout the history of the Roman Empire, was inefficiently administered. The Roman state simply had no apparatus for empire-wide enforcement of the imperial will. But the legislation that did issue forth was taken seriously in some places, leading to regional destructions of temples and pagan cult objects, including some of the great gold, bronze, and stone statuary of the empire. The best-known acts of enforcement involved one of the highest-ranking officials in Theodosius's administration, the Praetorian prefect, Maternus Synegius. Like Theodosius, Synegius was a deeply committed and zealous Christian. In 385 CE, he undertook a tour of the eastern provinces to carry out Theodosius's anti-pagan policies. In the words of one modern archaeologist, this tour led to an unprecedented devastation of the most admired object of pagan sacred architecture and art. Synegius spent considerable time in Syria, and with the backing of local Christian leaders, destroyed the important temple of Zeus in the city of Apamea. There's nothing to suggest that Synegius was personally active in Palmyra, but his presence in the region motivated local Christians to send in wrecking crews of their own. That is what happened with the Temple of Allat. It was a local job, inspired rather than carried out by imperial authorization. It's impossible to say whether the destruction was sponsored by the leaders of the Christian communities in the city, or was instead the work of a marauding mob of fervent Christians. We do know that, several decades later, Christian leaders converted other pagan temples into Christian churches, including the oldest and finest pagan sanctuary of the city, the famous Temple of Bel, whose remains were destroyed by ISIS in 2015. We grieve over such senseless, or rather highly intentional, destruction of antiquities in part because we see in remnants of ancient culture the treasured history of our own past. And so we are dismayed or even incensed, to hear a recent archaeologist declare, "There can be no doubt on the basis of the written and archaeological evidence that the Christianization of the Roman Empire and early medieval Europe involved the destruction of works of art on a scale never before seen in human history." The ancient world did not share our modern passion for the material remains of earlier millennia. The agony of that era's destruction was even more profound, since these temples and statues were still then part of a living, vibrant culture. The very core of people's personal and spiritual lives was under assault, mocked, mutilated, and destroyed before their very eyes. I do not want to undervalue the enormous benefits derived from the triumph of Christianity. Christians and non-Christians can surely agree that the cultural glories we have inherited from the Christian tradition, the art, music, literature, and philosophy, justify our gratitude and awe. But I begin with the Temple of Allat in Palmyra to emphasize my point. Every triumph is also a defeat, and the ecstasies of those who prevail are matched by the agonies of those who lose.
Chapter 1. The Beginning of the End. The Conversion of Constantine. Few events in the history of civilization have proved more transformative than the conversion of the Emperor Constantine to Christianity in the year 312 CE. Later historians would sometimes question whether the conversion was genuine. But to Constantine himself, and to spiritual advisors close to him, there appears to have been no doubt. He had shifted from one set of religious beliefs and practices to another. At one point in his life, he was a polytheist who worshipped a variety of pagan gods. Gods of his hometown, Naissus, in the Balkans. Gods of his family. Gods connected with the armies he served. And the gods of Rome itself. At another point, he was a monotheist, worshipping the Christian God alone. His change may not have been sudden and immediate. It may have involved a longer set of transitions than he later remembered, or at least said. There may have been numerous conversations, debates with others, and reflections within himself. But he dated the event to October 28, 312. At that point, he began to consider himself a Christian. The results were tremendous, but not for the reasons often claimed. It is not that Constantine eventually made Christianity the state religion. Christianity would not become the official religion of Rome until nearly 8 decades later, under the reign of Emperor Theodosius I. And it is not that Constantine's conversion was the single decisive turning point in the spread and success of the Christian religion, the one moment that changed all history and made the Christian conquest a success. At the rate it was growing at the time, Christianity may well have succeeded otherwise. If Constantine had not converted, possibly a later emperor would have done so, say one of his sons. Instead, what made Constantine's conversion revolutionary was that the imperial apparatus that before then had been officially opposed to Christianity and worked hard in some regions of the empire to extirpate it completely suddenly came to support it, promoting Christianity instead of persecuting it. Constantine did not make Christianity the one official and viable religion. He made it a licit religion, and one that enjoyed particular, even unique, imperial privileges and funding. This support did indeed advance the Christian cause. The recognition that this faith was now favored from on high appears to have contributed to the already impressive numbers adding to the growth of Christianity, including the conversion of increasing numbers of imperial and local elites, whose resources had until then funded, and thus made possible, the religious practices of their pagan world. As important as Constantine's conversion was to the welfare of the Christian movement, it is surprisingly difficult to describe what he converted from. Modern historians of religion who speak of conversion can mean a variety of things by it. Possibly it is simplest to keep the meaning broad and use the term to refer to a decided shift away from one set of religious practices and beliefs to another. That certainly happened with Constantine. At a moment that seemed, at least later in hindsight, to be clear and well-defined, he stopped being a pagan and became a Christian. Conversion was not a widely known phenomenon in antiquity. pagan religions had almost nothing like it. They were polytheistic, and anyone who decided as a pagan to worship a new or different god was never required to relinquish any former gods or their previous patterns of worship. Pagan religions were additive, not restrictive. Christians, on the other hand, did require a choice. Converts were expected to forgo the worship of all the other gods and revere the Christian God alone. Only Judaism had similar expectations and demands. Among pagans, that is, among the 93% or so of the world that by custom, habit, and inclination worshipped multiple gods, worshipping a range of divine beings was not a religion that anyone chose. It was simply what people did. Being a pagan meant participating in the various religious activities associated with the official state gods, local municipal gods, personal family gods, and any other gods that were known to be involved with human experience. For everyone except Jews, and then Christians, this was more a way of life than a conscious decision. It was a matter of doing what everyone had always done, very much like participating in the life of the local community, with the exception that most people were involved with only one community, but could be engaged in the worship of a virtually incalculable number of gods. For that reason, paganism should not be thought of as a solitary thing, but as hundreds, thousands of things. Those who practiced traditional religions, in other words, just about everyone, would never have recognized themselves as participating in something called paganism, or indeed, any kind of ism. There was not a thing there, nothing that could be named so as to sum up the totality of all the non-Jewish religious observances or beliefs or cultic practices of prayer and sacrifice ubiquitous in the culture. No pagan would have understood what it would mean to call themselves pagan. They were simply acting in time-honored ways of worshiping the gods. Constantine, like everyone else who was not raised Jewish or Christian, participated in this worship. But he gave it up to follow the one God of the Christians. The narrative of how Constantine became a Christian is both intriguing and complex. It involves issues that we today would consider strictly social and political, and other issues that we would consider strictly religious. But in the early 4th century, as in all the centuries of human history before that time, these two realms, the socio-political and the religious, were not seen as distinct. They were tightly and inextricably interwoven. On just the linguistic level, there were no Greek or Latin terms that neatly differentiated between what we today mean by politics and religion. On the practical level, the gods were understood to be closely connected with every aspect of the social and political life of a community, from the election of officials to the setting of the annual calendar to the laws and practices that governed social relations, such as marriage and divorce, to the administration of civil justice, to the decisions and actions of war, to all the other major decisions of state. The gods were active in every part of social and political life, and the decisions made and actions taken were done in relation to them. On the imperial level, this meant that it was widely known and genuinely believed by most that it was the gods who had made the empire great. The empire responded by sponsoring and encouraging the worship of the gods. Doing so would promote the commonweal. There was no sense that there was, should be, or could be a separation of church and state. Starting in the mid-third century, the emperors themselves sensed this full well and acted accordingly. That is why some years before Constantine converted, the Christian religion had been persecuted by order of the state. The Christians refused to worship or even acknowledge the gods of the empire, claiming, in fact, that these were evil, demonic beings, not beneficent deities that promoted the just cause of the greatest empire the world had ever known. The refusal to worship was seen by others to be dangerous to the well-being of the empire, and thus to the security of the state. And so, the decision to persecute, which seems to us, perhaps, to be a strictly religious affair, was at the time inherently socio-political as well. The Christians were to be removed like a cancer from the body politic. No emperor came to believe this more firmly, in no small part because of the alarming growth of this cancer, than Constantine's predecessor on the throne, Diocletian, who instigated the most vicious empire-wide persecution ever seen. Constantine himself was later to rescind the demands of this persecution. But while it was still in process, he converted. This conversion proved to be a linchpin of imperial history, not just for the fate of the Christian religion, but also for the workings of the Roman state. We will look at the persecution of Diocletian in a later chapter, and at the broader biography of Constantine in another. For now, we are interested specifically in his conversion and how it radically changed the balance of power, both for the persecuted Christians and for the running of the Roman government. To make sense of the conversion, we need to understand some of the political and religious backdrop to the story. Constantine's rise to power. By the end of the 3rd century CE, the empire was too vast and complex to be ruled by one emperor. It reached from Britain to Iraq and entailed virtually all areas connected to the Mediterranean, north into modern Europe, south into North Africa and Egypt, and east into Palestine and Syria, all the way to Persia. For many years it had been riven by internal disputes and foreign invasions. The year 284 CE is usually cited as the end of the major upheavals collectively known as the Crisis of the 3rd Century, a half-century filled, internally, with imperial assassinations and usurpations involving some 21 legitimate emperors and 38 usurpers. In addition, the empire had, for a time, been fractured by two breakaway states, one in the far west and one in the east. These had literally fragmented the empire and made the actual Roman state a slice of its former self. That is not to mention the incursions on the northern borders by barbarian hordes. The brilliant Emperor General Aurelian, ruled 270 to 275 CE, had defeated and reintegrated the breakaway states, but it was not until the reign of Diocletian that a fuller sense of order was restored internally, and with it a relatively secure border on the frontier. Diocletian was one of the truly great political administrators of Roman antiquity. His predecessors, including Aurelian, had never managed to bring any semblance of stability. Diocletian's 8 immediate predecessors had all been murdered, some of them within weeks or even days of taking the throne. He himself was to enjoy a reign of over 20 years. Diocletian was the first emperor of Rome to abdicate voluntarily. Diocletian is best known to casual readers of Roman history as the great persecutor of Christians. This he certainly was, as we will see more fully in chapter 7. But even more, he was an insightful and creative leader and administrator. Among other things, he devised the first sensible system for the transfer of power from one emperor to the next. Despite its theoretical virtues, however, the system broke down just over a year after the first transfer occurred, and Constantine himself played a definitive role in that collapse, leading to his own assumption of imperial power in a reign that was second only to that of the great Caesar Augustus himself in both length and historical consequence. From the time of Augustus, the first of the Roman emperors, the major political problem at the pinnacle of power had always been the succession. Once an emperor died, who was to succeed him? Augustus himself, unlike many of those who came in his wake, certainly had plans, and they always involved heirs who actually shared his bloodline. But one by one, these potential successors died, or if we believe the rumors, were assassinated, until virtually the last man standing was Augustus's stepson, Tiberius. As emperor, Tiberius, too, had no legitimate heirs to the throne, and so the world inherited Gaius, otherwise known as the infamous Caligula. The succession went from there, not always happily. Diocletian decided that there had to be a better way. He himself reigned with an iron fist for nearly a decade before carrying out his design. He devised a system of succession based not on dynastic ties, but on merit. It was a plan to keep the empire completely unified, but ruled through a college of 4 emperors, an administrative unit known as the Tetrarchy, rule of 4. There would be 2 senior emperors, each labeled an Augustus. Beneath each of them would be a junior emperor called a Caesar. The Caesars would be chosen based on their experience and qualifications. They would not be blood relatives of the Augusti. And so it happened. Diocletian became the senior emperor of the East with a military man named Galerius as Caesar. Another military officer, Maximian, became senior emperor of the West with Constantius, the father of Constantine, as his Caesar. Even though each emperor had principal responsibility for a distinct set of provinces, the empire was not technically divided into four units. Instead, the four were construed as co-rulers of a unified empire. The decisions of one were affirmed by the four. The conquests and victories of one were credited to the others. There were four emperors, but the empire was one. Most important was the rule of succession that Diocletian devised. When an Augustus died or abdicated, his Caesar would then move up and assume his vacated position, and a new Caesar would be chosen by the most senior of the two Augusti. This new junior emperor would not be the natural son of the newly elevated Augustus, but a figure uniquely qualified for the position. And so, in theory, the system could continue indefinitely, since successors would always be chosen, well in advance, for their abilities to perform the tasks of office, not because of the accidents of birth. It was a completely novel and rather ingenious conception. It was also doomed to failure. The children of current rulers could hardly be expected to accept the new system passively, and they didn't. Because of health issues, after a long and successful reign of over two decades, Diocletian decided to retire from office on May 1, 305. For the sake of a smooth succession, he compelled his rather unwilling co-Augustus, Maximian, to do the same, to make way for the two Caesars, Galerius and Constantius, to rise to the senior offices. For their replacements, according to the principles that Diocletian had devised, two Caesars were chosen as junior emperors. Maximin Daya, not to be confused with the outgoing Augustus Maximian, to serve with Galerius in the east, and Severus to serve with Constantius in the west. There was now a second tetrarchy. At the time, it may have seemed like a smooth and unproblematic transition, and in a sense it was, until one of the new Augusti died. Then the plan of succession based on qualifications ran afoul of both the dynastic principle and the army. The background of the story involves the new Augustus of the West, Constantius, and his son, Constantine. Constantine had risen through the ranks of military and political service over the years, as was natural for a scion of such a high-ranking official. He had served as a junior military officer in the court of Diocletian, and then for a brief time under Galerius. When Galerius was promoted to be the new Augustus of the East, he realized the potential problem with Constantine, who could well expect an appointment to the level of Caesar in accordance with the traditional dynastic principle. But Constantine was not named to the position, and almost certainly harbored some resentment and possibly some hope of remedy. If later reports are to be believed, Galerius's solution to this potential problem was to remove Constantine from the scene by regularly putting him in harm's way during various military endeavors. One later account, probably apocryphal, claims that Galerius, for his own amusement, once assigned Constantine to fight a lion, one-on-one. Constantine emerged from these attempts unscathed. Soon after, Constantius was elevated to the level of Augustus. He requested his son's transfer to his own service. Whether out of relief or in a moment of weakness, Galerius ceded to the request. In later propaganda, we are told that Constantine fled as quickly as he could, before Galerius could change his mind, and taking the fastest and only state-sponsored imperial route on horseback, hamstrung the horses left behind at each way station to prevent Galerius from fetching him back on second thought. Constantine, in any event, made it to Gaul, where his father was stationed, and joined him in his military campaigns on the borders, accompanying him to Britain to beat back incursions coming across Hadrian's Wall. It was there that Constantius took ill and died on July 25th, 306. That is when the dominoes began to fall. In designating his successor in the Tetrarchy, Constantius did not choose one of his great military commanders based on personal merit, but instead selected his son Constantine, returning precisely to the rule of dynastic succession that Diocletian had wanted to avoid. The problem is that Maximian, the rather reluctantly retired Augustus of the East, also had an adult son named Maxentius, who had, along with Constantine, felt slighted by being bypassed for a place in the imperial college at his father's abdication. Once Maxentius saw that Constantine's army had invoked the dynastic principle by acclaiming him ruler, he pushed to receive the same privilege. with his urging, the Praetorian Guard and the city of Rome proclaimed him emperor. He assumed control of Rome and Italy, and now the rule of four had become five. To complicate matters further, Maxentius brought his father Maximian out of retirement to assist him, so that now the five were six. But not for long. Civil War with Maxentius. The emperors Galerius, Severus, and Constantine all, rightly, considered Maxentius a usurper and knew they needed to dispose of him. There was no choice but civil war. It was not easy or swift. Galerius, the senior of the two Augusti, directed Severus to take his army into Italy and, if necessary, lay siege to Rome. Severus did so, but many of his soldiers defected to the opposing side, and he was soundly defeated in battle, personally captured, and soon thereafter forced to commit suicide. Galerius then decided to take matters into his own hands and attack Maxentius from the east. He too failed to complete the mission. Finding himself unable to enforce a viable siege on the city and experiencing numerous defections of troops, he fled Rome and barely managed to escape alive. During all this time, Constantine stayed away from the fray, conducting campaigns on his northern border against barbarian threats and allowing the other leaders of the empire to fight it out among themselves. He proceeded to do nothing about the situation for 6 years. Over that time, he learned of problems that Maxentius was experiencing in Rome, famine and food shortages resulting in riots, rampaging soldiers, unjust imprisonments and executions, and reports of Maxentius's own profligate activities. In 312 CE, he decided the time was right. In retrospect, he claimed he simply could no longer allow tyranny in the capital. What he did not point out in public was that overthrowing the alleged tyrant would give him possession of Rome, all of Italy, and North Africa. What especially matters for our narrative here is that, in addition to the enormous political and military consequences of a Constantinian victory, there was a highly unexpected religious outcome. This was to prove even more significant for the subsequent history of the Roman world. It was during his march on Rome, Constantine claimed later, that he experienced his conversion to Christianity. The march itself was a thing of military beauty. Constantine demonstrated his enormous military prowess, acting boldly and swiftly, accompanying his army over the Alps and destroying all resistance en route. After several victories over Maxentius's forces in northern Italy, along with the surrender of other strongholds that could see the writing on the wall, Constantine moved his army south, within striking distance of Rome itself, in preparation for an ultimate battle with the usurper, after which he would take control of the entire Italian peninsula. That is when Constantine had a vision. At least that is when Constantine later claimed he had his vision. One of the thorniest issues that biographers of Constantine contend with is the question of his vision, or rather his visions. As it turns out, we have several contemporary reports of several visions, all of them recorded by writers who personally knew Constantine and appear to be relating what they heard from him and or his companions directly. As a result, it is very hard to know whether Constantine had one vision or two or three, whether the vision or visions came while he was awake or asleep, whether they came while he was still campaigning in Gaul, or en route to Rome, or stationed just north of Rome on the night before his battle. To make sense of the reports that have come down to us, we have to put them in the context of Constantine's personal religious life, and that will require some further background. The Visions of Constantine. We have comparatively excellent sources for Constantine's adult life, including his own writings, laws he enacted, a biography written about him by the 4th century Christian bishop of Caesarea Maritima and father of church history Eusebius, and other contemporary reports. But we are handicapped when it comes to his life prior to his accession to the throne, including his religious life. For this, we have very slim records. We do know he was born in the northern Balkans, and we can assume that he originally participated in local indigenous religions that would have included such deities as the Thracian rider gods, divine beings astride horses. As was true of all citizens in the empire, he would also have participated in civic religious festivals, including the cults worshipping deceased Roman emperors. The Roman army, too, had its deities of choice. As a soldier and then commander, Constantine would have worshipped these as well. What we do not know is how well informed he was of Christianity in the years before his conversion. His mother, Helena, was later in life, well into Constantine's reign, a very committed Christian, and some have suspected that she had Christian leanings even in his youth, but we simply have no compelling evidence. We have a bit more information about his father, Constantius. Some observers have claimed he, too, for the Christian cause, none more famously than Constantine's biographer, the Christian Eusebius. It is indeed worth noting that during the original Tetrarchy, when Diocletian declared an empire-wide persecution, Constantius paid the policy little more than lip service, shutting down some churches but not arresting, torturing, or martyring any Christians. Was he a sympathizer, or even a devotee himself? Some historians have also been struck by the fact that one of Constantius's daughters, with a later wife, was called Anastasia, a Greek name that means resurrection, a highly appropriate name had her father been a Christian. It is not likely, however, that he was. More plausibly, Constantius, like the Emperor Aurelian some years earlier, was a henotheist, revering one god as superior to all others without denying the divinity of the others. In particular, he may have worshipped above all else the god of the sun, Sol Invictus, unconquered sun. That would make sense both of the fact that Constantine himself remained a pagan prior to his march on Rome in 312 CE, and of Constantine's later ruminations about what led him to the god of the Christians. We have three principal sources of information for the visions of Constantine that led to his conversion. The first comes to us in a flattering speech, known as a panegyric, delivered by an anonymous orator in 310 CE, before Constantine had initiated his final actions against Maxentius. The speech was occasioned by a military victory in a skirmish with Maximian, Maxentius's father, who had been brought out of retirement. As was always the case with panegyrics, the speaker himself wrote his address and made it entirely sycophantic. Such speeches were designed to praise the recipient as one of the greatest human beings the universe had ever seen, as revealed by the subject's activities and experiences. It was in the context of celebrating Constantine's marvelous character that the panegyrist of 310 CE described a vision the emperor had recently had of the god Apollo, who was often associated in ancient thought with the sun, and considered them the sun god. In the speech, we are told that, after winning his battle, Constantine decided to visit a magnificent temple of Apollo, probably at Grand Bauges, northeastern Gaul, modern France. There, outside the temple, Constantine had a vision of the god himself, who offered him several laurel wreaths, each of which symbolically represented 30 years of life, thus indicating that Constantine would be allotted a preternaturally long mortal existence. More than that, the god indicated that Constantine was the one who would rule the entire world. The panegyrist did not stop there, however. He went on to indicate that Constantine was a kind of human manifestation of Apollo himself. Among other things, like the god, he was young, handsome, and a bringer of health. If any such vision did occur, or if Constantine thought it occurred, or even simply said it did, this may well be the time at which he began to revere Sol Invictus. Possibly he became a henotheist. This would not have required him to stop being pagan, as we will see more fully in Chapter 3. He still could have acknowledged the divinity of other gods and recognized the right and even obligation of other people to worship them. But he may have turned his own entire focus onto the god he considered to be above all gods, choosing, as the emperor who aspired to be the greatest and most powerful human on earth, to worship only the greatest and most powerful divinity in heaven. The fullest version of Constantine's vision, or visions, appears in a record produced nearly three decades later. It is also the most important source for Constantine's conversion. The report appears in The Life of Constantine, a biography of the emperor by Eusebius, who had first-hand information from the emperor himself and claims that his account of Constantine's conversion was what the emperor himself revealed and swore to be true. Eusebius indicates that Constantine decided, for the good of the empire, to overthrow the tyrant of Rome, Maxentius. He knew that he would need divine help in his endeavor. To the regret of many a later historian, Eusebius does not tell us when exactly Constantine's appeal for heavenly assistance occurred. All he says is that it was on a military campaign he was conducting somewhere. Whenever it was, it happened before Constantine engaged Maxentius in the final battle for Rome. Constantine reflected on his religious options and realized that without help from above, his cause could not be won. Knowing well that he would need more powerful aid than an army could supply because of the mischievous magical devices practiced by the tyrant, he sought a god to aid him. He regarded the resources of soldiers and military numbers as secondary, for he thought that without the aid of a god, these could achieve nothing. And he said that what comes from a god's assistance is irresistible and invincible. He therefore considered what kind of god he should adopt to aid him. Clearly, Constantine was still at this stage operating within a pagan context, trying to decide where to appeal for divine help. As he reflected, he came to regard a polytheistic position as politically and militarily untenable, for a remarkably empirical reason. All of his predecessors on the throne had attached their personal hopes to many gods, and so worshipped them in expectation of success. But all failed miserably and met an unwelcome end. This, of course, was not true, but it is how Eusebius quotes the process of Constantine's thought. The one exception was his father Constantius, who died peaceably after having turned to the worship of only one god. Only his own father had taken the opposite course to theirs by condemning their error, while he himself had, throughout his life, honored the god who transcends the universe and found him a savior and guardian of his empire and a provider of everything good. Constantine, or more likely Eusebius himself, was now claiming that Constantius was not just a henotheist, but a worshiper of the Christian God. The historical record suggests otherwise, but at this stage, we are more interested in Constantine's thought process, at least as it is laid out in Eusebius's account. Constantine went on to realize that the two previous rulers who had attacked Maxentius, Severus and Galerius, had assembled their forces with a multitude of gods, and had come to a dismal end. Clearly, the polytheistic option was not working in the battle for Rome. And so Constantine came to a decision, concluding that it was folly to go on with the vanity of the gods which did not exist, and to persist in error in the face of so much evidence, and he decided he should venerate his father's god alone. Constantine turned to this one god in prayer, and he was rewarded with a vision. And not just he alone, he and his entire army. About the time of the midday sun, when day was just turning, he said he saw with his own eyes, up in the sky and resting over the sun, a cross-shaped trophy formed from light, and a text attached to it that said, "By this, conquer." He and the whole company of soldiers that was then accompanying him witnessed the miracle and were gripped by amazement. Constantine could not understand the meaning of the vision, and he pondered the matter until nightfall. Then, in a dream, Christ appeared to him, with the same sign Constantine had seen in the sky, directing him to make a copy of it as protection from the attacks of his enemies. Constantine apparently did not fathom what it was he had seen in either experience. In his confusion, he summoned several religion experts for an explanation. This is the clearest evidence that Constantine was not at this point desiring to become a Christian. He evidently did not fully realize who the Christian God was or what he stood for. He needed instruction. His advisors explained who Christ was as the only begotten Son of the one and only God, who could bring victory over death. They told him that the sign of the cross was a token of immortality. They proceeded to explain why Christ had come to earth and to unfold for him the meaning of the incarnation. Constantine marveled as he listened, indicating yet again that it was news to him, and decided to explore the divinely inspired writings for himself. He did so, and with the help of his advisors, deemed it right to honor the god who had appeared to him by worshiping him alone. Constantine then summoned his goldsmiths and jewelers and explained that he wanted a physical representation of the sign he had seen in his vision and dream, and they made it for him. At this point in his account, Eusebius injects a personal note, claiming that after the emperor had described to him the object, he brought it out to show him. It was a tall pole plated with gold with a crossbeam that gave it the shape of a cross. At the very top was a jeweled and gilded wreath on which were superimposed the two Greek letters chi and rho, which are the first two letters of the Greek word for Christ. Below the crossbeam was a suspended cloth. Eusebius indicates that this saving sign was always used by the emperor for protection against every opposing and hostile force, and he commanded replicas of it to lead all his armies,